This is Maggie Jones in Natural Wonders. I found an article about an animal I've been wanting to talk about for a long time. I was browsing the Prairie Enthusiast website, and I found one about the timber rattlesnake written by a scientist who's been studying them for decades. The website is theprairieenthusiasts.org, and under news, you can click on blog, and there you'll find things to read about that are fun. Identification and education is a good part to look at. There's also one inspiration. Get inspired by checking out recommended books, hiking spots, and feel-good stories. Management methods is here, and news, latest information, updates from chapters, and more. There's a lot here. And after the essay on the timber rattlesnake, I found a piece written by the prairie enthusiast ecologist Dan Carter about black swallowtail butterflies and their host plants in the carrot family. Among those host plants is wild parsnip. And someone had asked the question about going after parsnip and destroying the host plants of the swallowtail. Well, it turns out there are a lot more carrot family plants that are native and not problematic. So it's a very interesting discussion. And that's at the end. But first, this essay about the timber rattlesnake, written by Brian
Bielema,
and it's titled Timber Rattlesnakes, Vanishing Bluffland's Icon. And it was published March 13, 2020. And he writes, historically significant and emblematic of the wildness that once existed along the towering bluffs of the Mississippi River, the timber rattlesnake Crotalus horridus continues to survive in isolated pockets, revered and respected by Native Americans, with some tribes calling it grandfather. It was vilified by European settlers and now only thrives in the most remote mountain ranges of the eastern states. After centuries of persecution and wanton killing, a viable population still exists in the Midwest, and it's up to us to protect it. Stories maligning and demonizing the rattlesnake don't fit with the creature I've studied for 30 years. I hope to show you why Benjamin Franklin was right when he penned a multi-point document in support of using the rattlesnake as the symbol of our new nation, calling it an emblem of magnanimity and true courage. First and foremost, timber rattlesnakes have a passive temperament. They rely on cryptic coloration to go unnoticed and will almost always allow a human to pass by, maintaining silence even when a foot is placed well within striking distance. Their venom, needed to secure prey, wouldn't be wasted on an animal the size of a human. Even when stepped on, their usual reaction is to rattle and crawl away. If threatened, they may strike defensively. The vast majority of bites are known as illegitimate, because the wounds were inflicted during attempts to kill or capture them. Often these defensive strikes inject no venom, resulting in a dry bite with no systemic effects. Timber rattlesnakes are ambush predators. They brumate, inactive but not hibernating, in rocky dens from November to March and are active from April to October. This can vary, however, and with the warming climate, emergence generally comes earlier and ingress to dens later. Upon emergence, rattlesnakes seek open canopy rocks in the vicinity of their dens or move to a foraging site to await their first and often only skin shedding, molting of the year. Months in the den often result in skin lesions that are removed by this molting. Snake fungal disease has been found in the timber rattlesnake, which produces severe lesions, mostly on the head, but gratefully hasn't been lethal, as it has with Illinois' other rattlesnake, the eastern Massasauga. Each molting adds a segment to the snake's rattle string. Molting may take place a second time later in the summer or fall. After the rattlesnakes have completed their post-emergent molt, non-pregnant females and males search for ambush sites to forage for white-footed mice, eastern gray squirrels, and eastern chipmunks in closed canopy forests with many fallen logs or edges of grassy fields where voles, prairie and meadow, are the target. As an opportunistic predator, other mammals and birds also are taken as size permits. Ambush sites are chosen by sampling fallen logs for the presence of mouse runways by tongue flicking the tops to detect fresh scents. This technique also is employed on the sides of trees that may harbor gray squirrel nests. Once an ambush site is chosen, the rattlesnake rests its head on the side of the log or against the base of a tree, or it lies coiled next to a vole run. In this position, three senses come into play to direct the strike. With the jaw resting on the log, it can feel vibrations from a prey animal approaching. It also has good peripheral vision, but the most remarkable sense organs are the heat-detecting pits just below and slightly forward of the eyes. Warm-blooded prey is seen as a stereoscopic image not unlike that produced by a second set of eyes. This second sight allows the rattlesnake to strike accurately in total darkness. When a small mammal, such as a mouse, is struck, the snake immediately pulls back, avoiding injury from the wounded animal. The envenomated mouse wanders off and succumbs to the venom. After a brief wait, the rattlesnake follows the scent trail, finds and swallows it head first. Remarkably, the smell of the envenomated prey is distinctive, and the rattlesnake can track it through a maze of scent trails laid down by other mice. When birds are struck, the snake holds on until the venom takes effect, as a wounded bird would most likely fly, leaving no scent trail, and would be lost. The ambush position may be maintained for many hours, and the snake may actually fall asleep before approaching prey awakens them. It's recently been discovered the prior presence of other rattlesnakes may provide public knowledge of successful sites, drawing others to them by scent. One surprising benefit rattlesnakes provide humans is that eating their main food species, white-footed mice, reduces Lyme disease. Up to 90% of white-footed mice carry the Lyme bacteria, and tick larvae and nymphs become infected by biting the mice. If the mouse is consumed, both the disease carrier and its tick load is eliminated. It's estimated a single rattlesnake may consume more than 1,000 ticks annually, thus reducing Lyme disease in rattlesnake-inhabited areas. For pregnant females, life is quite different. They have built up fat reserves in the year or two prior and rarely feed during pregnancy until they give birth. Mating has taken place the previous summer to early fall, and both sexes may have multiple partners. This results in multiple paternities in some litters. Sperm is stored by the female over the winter, and the eggs are fertilized the following spring after ovulation. Rattlesnakes give birth to live young, not eggs. Pregnant females seek out open canopy, usually large table rocks, logs, or even man-made structures, where they remain until giving birth in late August or September. Some of these sites, known as birthing rookeries, are used by multiple females and may serve for decades as long as the canopy remains open and the structure is unchanged. Some females leave the rookery to give birth in sheltered areas nearby, but the majority have their litters at the gestation site. Fidelity to a gestation site finds females returning for successive pregnancies. Due to the fragile population in the Midwest, it's difficult to easily recover from the loss of even one mature female. Many females have a single litter in their lives, and few have two or three litters. In my 30-year study, Lifetime reproductive events break down as follows. 48.4% had a single observed event. 29% had two events. 9.7% had three. 6.5% had four. And just one female each had five and six litters in her life. Reproductive cycles for females with multiple pregnancies are usually 2 to 3 years. Reproductive maturity locally may occur as young as 4 years. I witnessed mating of a female with a complete rattle string. When the end button is present on the rattle, age can be estimated with some accuracy. Several experts agreed with this age after viewing photos. If she became pregnant the following year from this mating, she would have given birth at age 5. The eastern populations mature slower and may be as old as 7 to 9 years old before being able to reproduce. After giving birth, some mothers remain with their neonates, newborn snakes, until they complete their postnatal shed, usually within 10 to 14 days. But most females I've observed leave the newborn snakes after a few days of recuperation. Pregnancy exacts a high cost, and postpartum females are extremely emaciated. Some don't recover. Upon emergence the following spring, they remain in poor physical condition with visible loose skin folds on their depleted bodies. The young, litter size is 1 to 11, with a mean of 5.6. The young are born with a gray coloration, pre-buttons on their tails, and are about the size of a fat lead pencil in length and girth. After their molts, they look more like the adults in color and possess a button. Each successive shedding adds a segment below the button. When rattles reach lengths of 5 or 6 segments, they increasingly become prone to breakage. Old rattlesnakes rarely maintain their end buttons, and the 3-lobed broken end segments can easily be distinguished from buttons. Younger snakes tend to have tapering rattles, and charts prepared by several researchers can help determine age. Timber rattlesnakes are long-lived, with some reaching 45 or 50 years old, and by then have straight-sided rattles with almost no taper. As we learn more of the secret lives of timber rattlers through radio telemetry, videography, and other innovative experiments, we discover abilities beyond our previous understanding. Sociality and kinship recognition are present and important. Newborn snakes have the ability to find a den site within days of birth, with the mother gone, securing her own meal after her long fast. The neonates leave the birthing site, forage for food, but the remaining yolk allows them to overwinter without securing a meal, and if luck is with them, find the scent trails of older rattlesnakes moving back to the den. The young imprint on this den site and return here for the rest of their lives. In some cases, they may use another den, but there is high fidelity for the initial den. In this manner, some dens have been used for decades and probably centuries as successive generations continue the pattern. Their mental maps allow them to travel far from the den in loops, then bring them back in the fall. Although it's difficult to determine exact numbers of such a secretive and cryptic species, it's safe to say timber rattlesnakes in the Midwest need protection. In my native Illinois, it's listed as a threatened species and afforded legal protection. In the driftless area of northwest Illinois, where I study, I know of only 3 viable populations. I consider a viable population to have 50 to 100 snakes. Admittedly, I haven't surveyed this entire corner of the state, but would be surprised if there were more than 6 viable populations left. Throughout its upper Mississippi River range, most populations are isolated and losing ground as development encroaches. It took a commitment to save the bald eagle, eventually chosen as our country's emblem. Timber rattlesnakes, truly American symbols of wild blufflands deserve to have protection for their remaining populations, too, lest we lose them forever. And at the end here, it talks about the author. Brian has a bachelor's degree in zoology from the University of Illinois and master's in biology from Western Illinois University. His research on timber rattlesnakes began 50 years ago, and he co-authored the Illinois section of the Timber Rattlesnake Conservation Action Plan for the U.S. This article appeared in the spring 2020 edition of the Prairie Promoter, a publication of news, art, and writing from the prairie enthusiast community. I found another interesting part of the Prairie Enthusiast website. Under their identification and education section, effect of wild parsnip removal on black swallowtails, July 14, 2021. And this is a question from a member of the Prairie Enthusiast and the answer from Dan Carter. And Dan is ecologist for the Prairie Enthusiast. The question is, just wondering what protection measures you implement in removing wild parsnips to protect the black swallowtail butterfly caterpillar. Parsnips is one of their select host plant. I've been finding caterpillars on parsnips for years. I know it is a horrible plant, but we also need to be careful not to destroy a species. And Dan Carter replies, you raise the conundrum that is really at the center of everything that happens with land stewardship, everything we do to the benefit of one species, community, or ecosystem has reciprocal consequences for others that must be weighed against one another. Chapters and members have a very broad range of goals and approaches for the properties they care for, so I don't presume to speak for them, and I don't know if anyone is doing anything specifically to protect black swallowtail caterpillars as they control invasive species, but I don't think people generally are. The best I can do is give you my take. Generally, there should be a plan and or goals in place that any conservation action that takes place serves. In other words, it wouldn't make sense to eradicate parsnip just for the sake of doing so. Where the prairie enthusiasts are concerned, eradicating parsnip most often serves two separate goals. One is to establish or restore the diverse native vegetation associated with now imperiled natural community types that in turn supports a broader diversity of other life forms, invertebrates, vertebrates, fungi, particularly those dependent on vanishingly rare prairies, savannas, or other fire-dependent natural communities. Parsnip infestations impede doing so. The goal of establishing or restoring a diverse prairie calls for a different set of actions and priorities than the goal of promoting one or a few plant, insect, or other animal species. The other goal is to raise awareness of prairies and their value among the public and the particular hazard parsnip poses to people in the course of their interaction with nature can impede that goal. In my view, the most compelling argument for prairie conservation is the beauty of its flora and fauna, because the people whose imaginations are captured by that beauty are among the prairie's most loyal advocates. In most instances, the flora being encouraged through the eradication of parsnip will be more diverse and support a broader diversity of insects and other wildlife, including black swallowtails, because members of the carrot family are part of the native prairie, savanna, oak woodland, and sedge meadow communities we are often working towards restoring or reconstructing. Black swallowtail as a species benefits from using a broad range of native and exotic carrot family plants across the landscape, gardens, old fields, degraded woodlands, and high-quality remnant natural communities. So it is able to maintain populations on or readily recolonize areas where exotic carrot family plants like parsnip, poison hemlock, and wild chervil have been removed. For instance, I eliminated parsnip and Queen Anne's lace from our property early on, but we still have a good population of black swallowtail because we have seven other native members of the carrot family native to prairies and savannas. Black swallowtail remained present on the surrounding landscape where its weedy or invasive host plants were still present and was able to recolonize. But we now have a lot of other plant and insect species that we did not have before, and our children can romp around in it without fear of severe blisters. Native species I've observed black swallowtail larvae on include, but aren't limited to, golden Alexanders, smooth meadow parsnip, yellow pimpernel, honewort, anise root, sweet Sicily, common water hemlock, angelica, and black snake root, several species. It would probably be possible to move caterpillars off of parsnip or other host plants, but oftentimes caterpillars don't do as well if they are moved between species during their development. Doing this would also likely not be practical for larger infestations, but in the case of black swallowtail, the local population will be fine so long as other host plants remain present, because just about all of the landscape outside of mowed lawn, paved areas, and cultivated fields still supports host plants, and black swallowtails disperse well. So the sites we might manage by eliminating parsnip generally already support other host plants, or they will. I realize this may not get to the heart of your concern about the caterpillars on the parsnip, but concerns like yours either are or should be taken into account in the work that we do alongside all of the other factors that must be weighed in the course of good land stewardship. And that's Dan Carter, PhD. So I'm rummaging around and having fun looking at all the different articles and short pieces in the PrairieEnthusiasts.org website. There's so much here. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you so much for listening.